We're recording this is us. Now.
Okay.
And we'll see if we can order some coffee and or some wine or whatever you'd like.
I know I'm French, but it's a little bit early to drink wine.
All right.
The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast.
Emmanuel Gibello is a Parisian composer, musician, performance artist, and writer, and she is a guest this week on the podcast. We met while I was in Paris over the Christmas holiday. The conversation you're about to hear is an excerpt from a recording at the Café de Flore, one of the oldest cafes in Paris and a one-time hangout for writers, artists, and philosophers such as Georges Bataille and Pablo Picasso. You'll hear quite a bit of background noise in this episode, but you should think of it as ambiance. Again, this is just a clip from the full recording of the conversation, and the rest will be made available on our Patreon page for our members. It's Wednesday, January the 24th, 2018, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. In this episode, you'll hear excerpts from a YouTube video on Pierre Schaeffer, as well as a clip from his composition Étude de Brut, a clip from the movie Jurassic Park, along with a clip from Gibello's MTF Paris performance on an instrument she designed called the Moth. The music you're listening to right now is from the BBC Radiophonic Workshop. It's Delia Derbyshire, but in just a moment, you'll be listening to Emmanuel Gibello and I discuss writing sounds.
Emmanuel Gibello is how I would want to say your name. Is that correct?
Gibello.
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 Okay, and you are a composer of experimental music, yes?
This is one part of my personality.
Okay, and what is the other that you...
I start when I was studying, I start with visual art, and I was a performer, body performer.
You're a performance artist?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And
video also, mm-hmm. I was doing video.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of us, I was filming a lot. And then when I was, I think, 29 years old,
mm-hmm.
I was doing kind of, it was in 1919, I was doing a picture of numeric drawings. At this time it was more difficult than now, but,
mm-hmm.
and it was a big work to do, and my boyfriend at this moment of my life,
right.
had installed sound software, and so he was working, I was bored, and I just installed the software on my computer, and I've done my first track in uh-huh. like 24 hours, and then 3 months after I was invited to play at Instant Chaviré. I don't know if you know this.
No.
This is a very famous concert place in Paris. It's in Montreuil, in the suburb.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the experimental place
right.
to play, and where musicians from all over the world, from Japan, America, Canada, I don't know, all over the world, come and play.
Right.
I didn't know at this time what was Instant Chaviré, and shame on me, it was for Fondation Pierre Schaeffer, You know Pierre Schaeffer?
No.
You don't know Pierre Schaeffer?
Just explain everything. Because if I do know it, then maybe the listeners won't, and it would be good for you to explain.
So Pierre Schaeffer was... we have three Pierre in France. Pierre Schaeffer, Pierre Boulez, and Pierre Henry. Mm-hmm. Now they are all the three are dead. But they were composers, experimental. I think Boulez were not like, if you say experimental, but really they were very great composers. In the around the I think the 1945 around the war, they built a new lab. New music lab, new ways to do music. I think it was also about the recording, the technology.
Music concrete.
Pierre Schaeffer is the father of the music concrete. He invented it.
The technology for recording sound certainly started the revolution, the way we listen to music. For a long time, though, it stopped there. No one thought of recording as a way to make music. That is, until our next musical revolutionary came along. Pierre Schaeffer was an engineer, composer, theorist, philosopher, and novelist. In the late 1940s, he was working at the studios of Radio France in Paris. It was there that Schaeffer conceived of a revolutionary idea, to make music using audio recordings. This required a fundamental rethinking of what recording was about. Previously, it was for archiving, preserving, distributing. Now recording was to become a means of making music.
So I didn't knew who was Pierre Schaeffer. This is very shameful for French. But I was just starting. I didn't even know that I was doing music. So I was invited to in Instant Chaviret from the Pierre Schaeffer Foundation to play.
Right off the bat, you got to play.
I just started one month and a half after. It was just a very.
And how did that happen? How did you get invited to such a elite spot?
It's because when I was I was raised and I was born and raised in Paris. Mm-hmm. And when I was lycée, I don't know what is in America, it's before university.
Mm-hmm. In high school.
High school, yeah. The last years of high school, we were a group of students that were kind of artists. Mm-hmm. As I don't know the term in English, perhaps it's the same, cénacle. But yeah. We had Café de Flore, so you can say that it was a group of visual artists, musicians, writers. We were all in the same writing class. It was after school writing class. Mm-hmm. And we were writing novels and things like that. Mm-hmm. And for a French teacher of French writing, we were a little humble. We were a lot playing with this because we were just teenagers, so we just wanted to party. And and also fun fact, I think, is that we were organizing parties. These parties, everyone could come, but to come, you needed to do an artist act.
Yes.
It could be writing, it could be performing, it could be singing, it could be...
So you were throwing shows, and in order to come to the party, you had to be part of the show.
Exactly.
Yes.
And it was just teenagers' parties, so apartment. But you really needed to have an act. And so everyone was welcome.
See, growing up in the middle of, in Colorado, in Colorado Springs, at the high school parties I went to, it's just, if you had some beer, you could go.
And we were like... four or five really involved in it. Mm-hmm. And one of them was doing music, concrete music. And we were always a little bit rough and tough with the others, you know. It's right. Because we knew each other since we were really young.
Right.
So it was, if we didn't you know, French are not so nice with the others.
Right.
We're a little bit tough.
Right.
But it was tougher to speak with them because when I wasn't doing music, so I just told my friend Nicolas, I told him, okay, can you listen to what I've done? It's probably silly. And he just told me, oh, wow, that's crazy. You must come and show your music at this event.
But this was long after high school.
Yeah, 10 years after.
Right.
Yeah.
And you began doing what I call sound collage and electronic collage music.
Mm-hmm.
Would that be fair to estimation of what you create?
Depends. I think what I say I'm doing music with noise.
Just right, noise music,
yeah.
Yes.
No, but it's noise music, but it's also what I tell my nephews.
Mm-hmm.
It's just I take the noise of the life and I do music with it.
Right.
I think because noise music is very large, I think.
Right. This morning, before we mm-hmm. met, I was sitting at the breakfast table at our nice Airbnb and playing on the laptop with some of your music, and my daughter was, what kind of music is this? And she asked, and I played some other pieces that I thought in some way were similar to, say, it's sort of part of this whole tradition. And I started with John Cage. And say did a piece where he did something called Water Walk, where he just mm-hmm. on stage and making different noises in a obviously deliberate but not necessarily rhythmic way. And when we turn that off, my daughter says, "Now I'm hearing my chewing like it's music."
Yeah.
And we all ended up making little noises at the table quite intentionally. You know? And I feel like that is a large part of what you're doing, only rather than these sort of analog sounds or these small human sounds that John Cage was making mm-hmm. with implements, there's this digital machine kind of larger level of noise that you're orchestrating that coming through your computer. And it's like a sound of a city rather than the sound of a breakfast table. Would that be?
Yes, it's. But I think I'm not so much a musician than a performer, and
right.
I think I feel as if I was doing painting with the sounds, and because I'm not so much visual, and I don't recognize people normally.
Oh, really?
No, it's.
So you found me, luckily.
Yeah. But if people change. I don't recognize them.
Oh.
I recognize the voice. The voice is just something I can recognize for...
Right.
I was just, when I saw you, I just was
American.
Asking. No, I just was, oh, it could be this. It could be...
right, right. And you
Brian.
Were right.
And when you just answer, I was, okay, it's him. Because I heard your...
Podcast.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, yes. So you consider yourself to be more of a performer than a musician. So explain what the distinction is there in your mind.
Really, I don't know. The thing is that I'm from France, and in France, I was in high school and before that in American school. And I think it's a very important fact in my story, because in the US, it's normal to be in different boxes and do different things and change your work in your life.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just normal.
Right.
In France, you have to be in one little box and you can't go out of the box.
Mm.
And since I am a kid, I was always in the border.
Yeah.
Always. I don't like to be in a box. I mean, when I see that I'm in the box, I need to go out of the box and see what's in other boxes.
Right.
So for a time I was a performer. For a time I was probably a musician, composer.
Mm.
And you can say that I am a composer because people, I have also written pieces that are played by other people. So
I saw that.
So
yeah.
This is composition, but it's also in performance or dance. You can have people that play
right.
your piece. So I'm some, yeah, you can say musician for that. I also developed two instruments to play my music, but because I needed some, I work a lot about the chaos theory.
Mm-hmm.
You know, chaos theory?
Yes.
And so the spinning top that I use on my one of my instruments, it's named the Molf.
Mm-hmm.
I really use it all the time, to when, even when I have to compose music for a movie. I even if it's not for performing, it's really my instrument. I play with it.
Premier point. Premier point. Premier point.
Still not clear on chaos.
It simply deals with predictability in complex systems. The shorthand is the butterfly effect. A butterfly can flap its wings and be king, and in Central Park you get rain instead of sunshine.
And did I go too fast? I go too fast. I did a flyby. No, give me that big glass of water. We're going to conduct an experiment. It should be still. The car's bouncing up and down, but that's okay. It's just an example. Now, put your hand flat like a hieroglyphic then. Now, let's say a drop waterfalls on your hand. Which way is the drop going to roll off? Over which finger or over the thumb or the other side?
Thumb. That's it.
Uh-huh. Okay. Right. Okay, now freeze your hand. Don't move. I'm going to do the same thing. Start with the same place again. Right. Which way is it going to roll off?
Let's say back. Yep. Same way.
Same back. Change. Why? Because tiny variations, the orientation of the hairs on your hands.
Hey, Alan, look at this.
The amount of blood distending your vessels, imperfections in the skin.
Imperfections in the skin?
Microscopic, and never repeat and vastly affect the outcome. That's what?
Unpredictability.
All right.
You've been composing for movies, some.
So, yeah, a little, yeah, some.
So, anything I might have seen, like The Last Jedi, or?
No, I don't think so. Mostly documentary, French documentaries.
So, like, what kinds of documentaries, then, are you involved with? That someone say, this is the kind of sound, this is the kind of ambiance that I want for my documentary. What subjects were you?
There was some subject about artists,
mm-hmm.
And about an old factory, chemistry factory, and in Besançon, it's in east of France. That was very strange because the producer of the documentary heard me on the radio in like 2 or 3 years before he called me.
Mm-hmm.
He was just starting the idea of his documentary. And he just thought, oh, wow, I need this music. I want her to do the music of my documentary. Then he called me 3 years after. And the fun fact about it is that my grandfather was a chemist and worked in this factory.
Oh.
And so in the attic of the family house, we have, because he was a chemist and he was testing all the machine to do nylon.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of the inventors, the group that invented nylon and artificial silk, and he was working on that. Mm-hmm. And so we have in the attic a lot of old fabric and tests and everything. And that, for me, it was just amazing when I was a kid to go, and still now I love to go in the attic.
Mm-hmm.
And just mostly I'm someone we imagine. I like to imagine things, invent things, and it's why I invented these machines. And now since 1 year I'm writing, so I'm not so much in music. Now I'm writing a novel, and I'm also more working on documentaries and more political. You want a coffee?
Yeah, coffee.
What kind of coffee?
Large one, yeah, café.
With milk?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Un café au lait, et moi je vais me prendre un espresso, s'il vous plaît. Avec un peu serré, le mien, mon espresso, et de l'eau, s'il vous plaît. Merci.
You mentioned Samuel Beckett.
Yeah.
Haruki Murakami and Philip K. Dick as three of your influences. In Philip K. Dick's case, he was very much influenced by certain kinds of experimental music out of California. It features prominently in his book Valis, how he would just listen to this, one note, like I think it's in C, but I'm not sure, you know, for days and days, and have mystical experiences. So what brought you to Philip K. Dick in particular?
Because I have one passion in my life since I am able to walk, I think, is the writing. My parents had thousands, but really thousands and thousands of books at their home. It was more than 10,000 books, and there was book all over the house, everywhere. It was a huge apartment. It was like 300 square meters. They were intellectuals, and so we had a big placard, because we had a big corridor with inside this placard, a closet. There were 20 closets.
Filled with books?
Some were for the clothes, but like perhaps three or four. And the others were for books. But it was one was the Jewish literature. One was the science fictional literature. Right. Another one. And also they were the library, even in the toilet we had books. And we had also psychiatrist books, because my parents were psychiatrists, and philosophical books, and so.
I just don't think there would be many composers who would say, "Oh yes, my big influence is Philip K. Dick." You know,
but
you are not. You bring all these different disciplines together, and it's not so strange that you would cite Philip K. Dick. But I do want to ask, how is it that writing and the kind of sound collage, or I almost think of it as an ambient kind of noise, you know? How are these things the same?
Or reading verbs too, also, because you ask me the influence. It's just that when I read, I told you I am not a visual at all. I really feel, even here, I feel the sound. I can. It's like as in the Matrix.
Right.
For me, everything is sounds, and it's the vibration of sounds. And when I remember people, I don't see them, I really hear them.
Mm.
Or when I think of a place, I can hear the place. I remember the noise and etc. And for me, the words are the in-between with the sound and the visual. And and also I was raised without television. This is very important. And I know my parents didn't want me to have anything about the popular culture.
Right, but they had a whole closet full of science fiction.
So I had, to take what I could to do things. So I just started to read. I was reading all the time since I remember me looking at books when I was like 2 years old.
Right.
So it's
before you could really read, or
yeah, before I could really read, and my mother told me that before when I was like 1.5 or 2 years old, I was always writing on papers, taking a book, and writing what I was seeing. I wasn't drawing. I was just always copying things. So for me, books are just something very important in my life. I don't have but before I had always a book with me. Always, always. I am an addict. If I don't have a book, so when I'm
putting my books down on the table. These are all books that I brought with me. Most of them are books that we've published, but just for, I have not opened them while we've been here. I have not had time. But I said to my wife this morning, why did I bring all of these books? And I have not had a chance to read any of them. And she said that they make you feel comfortable. It's
exactly. It's reassuring.
Yes.
Yeah, I think I will.
So what books did you bring with you today?
I didn't
You didn't bring any books?
No, but
you met me without a security blanket.
I have my own
book. So when did you start working on your novel?
In July 2016.
Okay, so not so long ago.
No.
You're on track.
Yeah,
you will finish this book.
I hope. I don't know, because it's the first for me, and it's also all the joy to be the first time.
Oh, yes.
Well, you know, I know that it's not the first time I write, because one of my friends told me, oh, I remember when you were 18, you were writing a novel. The main character was a woman, and she was called Her. This summer, I moved from my apartment. I was there since 17 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I had totally forgot about this novel I was writing when I was 18 years old.
Right.
And I find in my old artistic drawing book.
Yeah, your sketch pad.
Exactly. Some notes about the novel. And I was like, wow.
You held on to it a long time.
Yeah. But it's not at all the same story. But when I was 5 years old, my dream was to be the youngest writer of the world.
As a writer, I find that trying to remember why it was important to write, and specifically why it was important to write books rather than screenplays or plays or poems, which I was never attracted to poetry. I think I'm just too American for that. But it's something about a book which seems to last. They seem to last. I mean, in reality, they don't all last. And many, many books are forgotten completely. But they seem to last. So and you can be reading someone who's long dead and still feel like they're right next to you. That's part of it. But I do think it's more about...
The coffee's arriving.
Ah.
C'est juste que nous sommes, on est en train de faire une interview. Oui, je merci beaucoup de votre attention. Merci.
So we're pouring the water. Oops. I should just say, we're at the Café de Flore. When I spoke to Michael, we spoke of your work.
Mm-hmm.
And I gave my opinion of it at the time. And you seemed to like my opinion of it at the time, which is that I said that it seemed to me that you were working on trying to bring lived experience and the sound of life, especially urban life, to art, and bring art to urban life, and that it had something to do with an avant-garde aim, a revolutionary aim, to make over life as a kind of art rather than, to have the rather than run under capitalism or under a monarchy, life would be run under the system of art.
From now on, De Boer said, the art of the future will be the creation of situations or nothing.
The situation is they wanted to devaluate everything which was a part of the modern society. And for sure, for them, art market, art dealing with art, was something that should be ruined.
They want to not only negate art, but as the way De Boer put it, also realize it, which is to say, make of daily life a creative, continuously original, delirious, ecstatic experience.
I don't think so much. I just live my life always with imagination, and so for me it's just... I don't try to... I mean, life is art, and
right.
There is, I can't, and it's probably also, I'm probably not, I probably don't fit as the majority of the humans, because I just always see things. And I think it's why I love Philip K. Dick and Haruki Murakami. Mm-hmm. It's because I always try to see everything with another point of view and another one, all the facets of a moment. But even if I'm just walking in the street, even if I am not recording or if I am recording, I just look small moment in the life, and just I was distracted with this, I think, Japanese man. I was okay, I should help him to order, and then I was, no, you need to focus. I always think, okay, you should note this because it can be in a novel,
right,
or it can also be or not this magical sound moment that can be in a composition, or I think life is artistic and creative all the time.
Yes.
It's probably people who were afraid to see it and need a lot of person need to be in something very straight because it's reassuring for them, and they are afraid of that things can change. And
well, I'll say this: when I was younger, in my 20s, and I was kind of coming into adulthood, I'd already grown up, but I was coming into adulthood, living in Portland, Oregon, which is where I still live. I was involved in political organizations, which had a tendency to be nostalgic for the late 60s and 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were all trying to pretend as though we were still living in that moment,
okay,
68 through the 70, two or three or so. And so, you know, we did acid, and we smoked a lot of marijuana. We read Hermann Hesse, and we talked about, you know, metaphysics, and we talked about getting back to kind of an authentic lived experience, a way of letting our true natures come forward and direct our lives. And we thought of that as political as well. You know, if we could get touched down on authenticity, we would be able to break free from bourgeois society, right? And so I consider myself to be an anarchist and all of that kind of thing. It was probably in my late 30s where I became a square again. I returned to my roots and wanted to be, you know, systematic and more constrained and it was because I saw the economic crisis of 2008 happen and realized I didn't understand why it was happening and what the systems were that were making it happen, and that no amount of cries for authenticity were going to help in this moment. So I've come to a position now where I don't believe in authenticity. I believe everything is mediated. Everything is a way of, as an interpretation. Everything has a system. There may be different systems, and some are much better than others. And that the radical task is to devise new ones and more interesting ones than what we have now, rather than find that bedrock of real, authentic experience.
I think that we could have met when we were 20. If we were living in the same city, because I also was more very involved in politics, and there is something probably I'm not. It's why I'm not. I don't feel I am a musician, because music is, when I meet composer or musician, they are really about the techniques, some beauty about a jest, or about a sound that is coming, or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I need to tell stories, but to tell true stories and to try to make changes, and that people can think differently, and that's terrifying. Thank you.
Je pense que les cours d'instruction civique, moi, je pense que les enfants sont les plus importants.